From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 50 years to life, that's the punishment for Leandro Andrade, convicted of shoplifting $153 worth of children's videos in a California Kmart. Gary Ewing got 25 years to life for stealing golf clubs. Both men were sentenced under California's tough three strikes law, passed in 1994. It was part of America's wave of get tough on crime legislation. 26 states have three strike laws, but none as tough as California's. In this hour, three strikes and your crime and punishment may be enormous. Is that correct or is that inhumane? You be the judge. We begin in Washington, where yesterday the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in two California cases. Dahlia Lithwick is senior editor and Supreme Court correspondent for Slate.com. I asked her to describe the basic issues being considered by the court in these cases.
There are a pair of cases that have similar facts. They both involve sort of career petty criminals. These are not, you know, dangerous, violent felons, but they're both routine burglars and robbers who committed third strikes under California's three strikes, you're out law. And in both cases, because of a quirk in California law, these minor robberies, one guy shoplifted $150 worth of videos from Kmart and the other stuck some golf clubs down his pants. Both of these are sort of crimes for which ordinarily you'd get a year or 2 years. But because these are counted as third strikes in California, these misdemeanors are bumped up to felonies. They are going away for life.
Life meaning?
Well, the guy with the golf clubs is going away for 25 years, and the guy who stole the videotapes is going away for 50 years.
And given their ages, each of those sentences might well amount to life.
Well, certainly the Gary Ewing who stole the golf clubs is already dying of AIDS, so 25 years will be more than his lifetime. The other will be released at age 87.
A California court found that this was too much, that this was disproportionate punishment.
Right. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the appellate court that reviews California cases, found that one of the two cases, Andrade case, the videotape case, was in fact excessive under the Eighth Amendment bar on cruel and unusual punishment, that you just can't throw someone away for life for stealing some videotapes from Kmart.
You quote Justice Anthony Kennedy saying, asking whether the weight of their consideration should be on proportionality or just on the triggering crime. He said, if the entire focus is to be on a few golf clubs, we're like some judges out of Victor Hugo. You must be thinking of Les Mis. What was the tenor of the justice's questioning of attorneys yesterday?
Overwhelmingly, the tenor was this feeling of, look, these guys are career criminals. This is not about a bunch of golf clubs or videos. These are guys who have made a lifetime out of petty crime. And Scalia, Rehnquist, Kennedy, O'Connor all sort of sounded very sympathetic to the argument that these guys are just going to do it again, so let's lock them up.
Is that the argument that the state of California is making? We need to have this tough barrier to even small crimes to keep the crime wave from washing over us?
It was. I mean, one theme in the California attorney's argument is that the statistic that about 6% of the criminal population commits between 60 to 70% of all crimes, and that the best thing we can do is just incapacitate them, which is the penological fancy word for lock them up for life, and crime rates go way down. And so that is their argument, although I think it's important to distinguish that from the original theory of three strikes, you're out, which was get incredibly violent felons off the street. Now we're talking about cases where both of these guys, and in fact many of the guys who have petty misdemeanor third strikes, stole pizza and they stole vitamins. I mean, these are not dangerous, violent felons, but they are career recidivists.
Now, the lower court said this is too much. Is it surprising that the Supreme Court's tone would be so tough as it looks into these cases?
It's surprising only in that the Supreme Court has a history of saying, look, we do need to do some kind of proportionality analysis in these cases, and that there have been cases in the past, Supreme Court cases, where, for instance, it was found in a 1983 case, a 1991 case, that locking up someone for passing a bad check that was worth $100, locking him up for life, even if he was a career recidivist, was simply excessive. So the court has tended to show sympathy to these cruel and unusual punishment arguments. And as you recall, last year they invalidated executing the mentally retarded again on this cruel and unusual Eighth Amendment analysis. So it was sort of surprising that even some of the liberal justices like Ruth Bader Ginsburg just didn't seem to evince any sympathy for these guys. They sort of seemed to say, look, you know, I don't care if it was just a Snow White videotape. This guy is a career criminal. And it was a little bit shocking, the lack of, I guess, proportionality, that they seem to think that these crimes were serious enough to warrant lifetime incarceration.
Though you're right that Sandra Day O'Connor did find the California case being made a little much at points, or something about a lifetime sentence for parking tickets.
I think she was trying to tease out where California was going to stop, what was the limiting principle.
Mm-hmm.
And she was getting frustrated with one of the attorneys who, I think both the attorneys in this case were having trouble sort of articulating a limiting principle. On the California side, they seemed to be saying, look, if we want to lock someone up for life for jaywalking, we're entitled to do that. She didn't have a lot of patience with that argument. But on the other side, Justice Souter, for instance, said to one of the attorneys, look, if someone stole 3 golf clubs 50 times, don't you think we're entitled to lock him up? And the attorney on that side also wasn't willing to articulate a sort of principle at which, yes, at that point we have someone with a problem. And I think both sides really suffered from the same problem, which is if you take their theory to an extreme, they look completely ridiculous and improbable. And I think that was on both sides something that the justice struggled with.
So it was just day one, but if you take the tenor of that day, it looks as though the Supreme Court could come back and support California and say, sure, Cinderella videotapes, lock them up.
And as I say, surprisingly, because the majority of the court has tended to be sympathetic to these proportionality cases, but it's surprisingly, I think, predictable that this case will go the way of California.
Dahlia Lithwick, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Dahlia Lithwick is senior editor and Supreme Court correspondent for Slate.com. She spoke with us from Washington. Are 3 strikes sentencing laws cruel and unusual punishment? If you do the 3rd crime, should you simply do the time, even if it's a lifetime? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Kensington, California, is Franklin Zimring, law professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of Punishment and Democracy, 3 Strikes and You're Out in California. Good evening and welcome, Frank Zimring.
Good evening, sir.
Thanks so much for being with us. Tell us about the history of this law in California. About half the states in the country have 3 strikes and you're out laws now, but they're not all as tough as California's. How did this come into being?
Well, essentially, it came into being sort of outside the Beltway. This was something that was created by citizen activists out here on the West Coast. We have things called initiative processes.
We know them here,
and,
too.
In the case of California, a gentleman by the name of Mike Reynolds, together with the National Rifle Association, wrote himself a proposal, and his timing was very good because the Pauley class kidnapping in 1993
mm-hmm.
Suddenly created a situation where anything that was going to get tough on crime was going to pass. Usually the problem with crime statutes is that nobody reads the fine print. In California in 1994, nobody was reading the big print.
This was after the kidnap and murder in Petaluma of Pauley Class. She was 12 years old at the time.
Yeah. And at this point, the law was passed both by the legislature and then validated by the voters. The clear intention of the political establishment was cracking down on violent criminals, although the prior strikes could also include burglary, which was the least serious of the crimes,
mm-hmm.
but is typically a property crime. Now, I'd want to make 2 corrections on what your first interviewee said.
Please.
About the case that's before the Supreme Court this week. The first one is that it is not all of the California 3 strikes law that's being challenged.
Mm-hmm.
There have been 50,000 sentences under the California law. Fewer than 500 of them were being challenged.
I've read 50,000. I've read that there are something like 7,000 offenders serving 25 years to life.
25 years to life, because 90% of the sentences under the California statute aren't for people with 2 prior strikes, but for people with only 1. California passed a law that's mislabeled when it says 3 strikes. In fact, if you have a single burglary conviction, you're going to have a trebling of your prison time and mandatory prison. That one state law in California is responsible for 93% of all the sentences nationwide under the three strikes and you're out.
Now, a California state law affecting sentences nationwide? I'm not following that.
Okay, what I said is that in California, there have been more than nine times as many sentences under its law as there have been under the other 25 laws put together.
Ah, so this is the draconian one.
Well, this is the one which is broad and sweeping. And the challenge that was put to this law was only put to two of its most extreme cases that were absolute accidents, not the sorts of things that the people who drafted the three strikes law were thinking about.
Frank Zeming, to help us understand this even better, give us an example. How does it come to be that someone convicted of stealing vitamins or pizza or golf clubs or videotapes ends up in prison for 25 or 50 years to life under this law? It still eludes me.
It's a 100-year-old accident. What the three strikes law says is that any felony that is committed becomes the basis for a 25-to-life sentence.
But stealing vitamins is
a
felony?
It's not a felony. No, it isn't. Now we get into the 100-year-old accident. Since 1872, a different California law has said that anyone with a prior felony conviction for a property offense,
okay,
and bear with me on this one, Tom, if he is convicted of petty larceny, for which anybody else can only go to jail for less than a year.
Petty larceny, that would be taking a bottle of vitamins.
That would be taking a stick of gum in California.
Okay.
For anybody else, the maximum sentence would be less than a year in jail. It's not a felony. But if you have a prior property conviction, that means all of a sudden the petty with a prior rule tells you it's a felony. And once it becomes a felony, and the people who drafted three strikes weren't thinking about this, then since any felony gets you to the 25 to life, you have this sort of double bootstrapping.
So if you have the wrong background and steal that stick of gum, it can be elevated to a level that puts you in the slammer for a long time.
Yeah, but now it gets sort of interesting because three strikes and you're out was really about the serious and violent criminals. And the problem with that petty with a prior rule is that if you had two convictions for forcible rape or two convictions for attempted murder and you stole the same things Mr. Andrade stole.
Videotapes.
Yeah. You could only go to jail for less than a year because, you see, the bootstrapping doesn't occur because your previous felonies, though much more serious, weren't property crimes. So what the attackers were arguing in court is that the scheme that was put in place by California for those kinds of offenders was outrageously disproportionate and irrational.
Do you agree, Frank Zimring?
Well, I think it has to be even to get to court, because the second disagreement I'm going to have with your first interview is that when it comes to second-guessing prison sentences, the Supreme Court of the United States is enormously reluctant to get involved. In death sentence cases, federal law and the Eighth Amendment has become a very important presence.
That is the amendment against cruel and unusual punishment.
Yes. But with regard to prison sentences, in the last century, only two ordinary prison sentences have ever been reversed under the Eighth Amendment. And a whole variety of penal statutes have been upheld.
So that would suggest that this Supreme Court may not get involved. Frank Zimring, thank you so much for laying out the background for us. Franklin Zimring is professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of Punishment and Democracy, Three Strikes and You're Out in California. It's exactly what we're talking about tonight, about three strikes, you're out in America's courts and California's courts, about crime and life sentences and justice. Is three strikes and you're out good American justice? If the third strike, the third crime, is stealing a Cinderella video, should you still be put away for life? You can join us at 1-800-848-9222. 888-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about three strikes and you're out sentencing in California's courts and America's courts about crime and life sentences and justice. You heard the introduction. Do such draconian punishments deter crime? Or do they become blind revenge? Do we need to put thieves of golf clubs and vitamins away from for life to deter a larger wave of crime? Is this like Victor Hugo's France, where Jean-Paul Jean is made a galley slave for stealing a loaf of bread? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined now by Evan Lee. He's joining me from San Francisco. He's professor of criminal law at the University of California Hastings College of Law. Good evening and welcome, Professor Evan Lee.
Thank you. Good evening, Tom.
Good to have you. I'm also joined by Charles Hobson. He's an attorney for the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation. He's joining us from Sacramento. His group filed an amicus, a friend of the court brief, in both of these California cases before the Supreme Court. Good evening, and thanks for joining us, Charles Hobson.
My pleasure, Tom. Thanks a lot.
Charles Hobson, let's start with you. I guess you're advocating along the lines of the state of California that these laws are just, appropriate, and right, and you need them. Why?
Quite simply, a very small portion of people commit a very, very large percentage of crimes. People like Andrade and Ewing, the two people before the United States Supreme Court.
That's Mr. Videotapes and Mr. Golf Clubs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Actually, Mr. Three and Four prior felonies also, mm-hmm. serious felonies also, and many more convictions than that. Mm-hmm. They have demonstrated an inability to conform to the law. They're repeatedly caught and convicted of crimes, repeatedly put in jail, and they come out and they continue to commit crimes. And in the Ewing case, the one most directly before the U.S. Supreme Court, he was basically either in prison, on parole, or on probation for a 12-year span before he was finally caught for his last crimes.
What are you seeing in California in terms of how small a portion of the population commits what portion of crimes?
There haven't been any truly California-specific studies. The studies that do exist range from 5% of the people committing 75% of the crimes to about a third of the people committing about three-quarters of the crimes. These studies have been going on since a little bit after World War II.
And California has now had this three strikes or two strikes. You count them, and you're out sentencing guidelines for less than a decade. Have they been effective?
It's always hard to measure the effect of criminal statutes or anything regarding crime because you can't conduct experiments like you can, like in physics or in medicine. Mm-hmm. But what we have noticed is that there was a decrease in crime in California greater after the passage of the three strikes law than occurred before the three strikes law. Also, crime fell, both violent and nonviolent crime, more rapidly in California after the three strikes law was passed than it did in the rest of the United States.
We've read your Secretary of State, Bill Jones, pointing to a 40% reduction in crime. Of course, during that same period, the Sentencing Project, a group in Washington that opposes three-strike laws, says serious crime also dropped 41% in New York, 33% in Massachusetts, 31% in Washington, D.C. So is it really this draconian sentencing, or is it coincided with a general diminution in crime nationally?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily call it draconian, more as just and deserved. But it's hard to compare from state to state because the situations in states can vary tremendously. For instance, in Washington, D.C., there have been horrible, horrible wars concerning crack cocaine, which were abating mm-hmm. sometime around when three strikes was passed. This could also have an influence in parts of California, certainly the more urban parts. But on the other hand, less urban parts of California, this didn't happen. And you have to think, did the three strikes law have some effect on it? As a matter of common sense, you have people who keep committing crimes, and all of a sudden they're incapacitated, they can't commit crimes anymore. Another anecdotal
incapacitated meaning was, they're in prison for life, more or less.
Oh yeah, not life, for 25 years to life. And actually, also remember, the two strikes provision, actually about 90% of the people sentenced under the three strikes law are under the two strikes provision rather than the three strikes provision.
Mm-hmm.
The two strikes provision doubles the sentence after if you have one prior what's called serious or violent felony.
So Mr. Andrade had a 50-year sentence he was looking at, 50
yes,
to life.
Yes, because he had, as I recall, four prior serious or violent felonies and three prior serious or violent felonies and several other prior convictions, including a federal escape including escape from federal prison.
Charles Hobson, stand by. Evan Lee, I want to turn to you on this because we hear the case Charles Hobson is making and he's made in an amicus brief with the state of California before the Supreme Court. He says these are not draconian sentences. These are just and deserving. On the other hand, when we see the precipitating crime, in this case, three Galloway golf clubs in someone's pant leg or $150 worth of videos from Kmart that were supposed to be Christmas presents, it just sounds horrible.
Yeah, I would use the word grossly disproportionate, which is, I think, the phrase that Justice Kennedy used in his Harmelin concurrence. But let me address a couple of points that Mr. Hobson made.
Please.
One is that he says, and we're not exactly sure what the statistics are, but something like 5% of the offenders are committing a very large percentage, say 70 or 75% of the offenses. And this, I assume, this statistic is offered to sort of draw our attention away from the disproportionality of the sentence. I don't really think that makes sense. If I were to tell you, if we were to find, for example, mm-hmm. that 5% of the drivers on the road commit, let's say, 70% of the traffic offenses, would you want the 5% of the traffic those 5% of drivers locked up for life?
Well, but this was kicked off by Polly Klass. She was 12 years old. She was kidnapped. She was murdered. It's not exactly crossing a double yellow line.
No, that's exactly right. And my whole point is it's disproportionality that we're talking about here. I mean, the whole point of the concentration of offenders in a few people can't bring us away from the central issue, which is disproportionality. The other thing that I wanted to say was about deterrence, and I do agree with Mr. Hobson that it's extremely difficult to determine exactly whether criminal laws do have deterrent effect or not, precisely because of what he said. There's no laboratory conditions. But what I would point out is that in the period of time that we're talking about, three strikes in California was passed in 1994, and up to, I believe, the statistics stop at around 2000 or 2001, if I'm correct on that. You have to understand, not only, as you pointed out, are we seeing nationwide decreases in crime, which suggests that it is not California three strikes law that's doing it. But also you have to remember that during much of that time, California was experiencing unprecedented economic growth. And there has been a lot of research done in the past to show that economic growth or contraction has a lot to do with crime rates, and probably a lot more.
Even with that, we read that California has something like 160,000 inmates more than France and Germany combined. Is this huge prison population being driven by mandatory sentencing like this, Evan Lee?
Oh, absolutely. And, I can tell you that now with California in the midst of a recession, the one growth industry in the state of California is building prisons. Now that the high-tech industry is out, the one thing that you can make money on now is building prisons.
But there was a crime wave, and we all remembered in the 1980s and early 90s, the whole country was just flipping out at how much crime was out there. People felt this urgent need to draw a line in the sand somewhere. Is there no place for mandatory sentencing as saying to potential criminals, you cross this line and you're going away, period, and we need that to put a finger in the dike here?
Well, I think there needs to be an important distinction drawn. I mean, when you say mandatory sentencing, when you talk about mandatory minimums, or you can talk about determinate sentencing mm-hmm. as opposed to indeterminate sentencing, which was sort of the regime that we had throughout the nation in the 1960s and the 1970s, I have no problem with determinate sentencing as a concept. But three strikes is determinate sentencing on steroids and on acid. It's just crazy. It's not at all tailored to individualized justice.
Charles Hobson, how about it? Evan Lee describes this as a kind of an unjust bulldozer here, just rolling over the details.
Well, it's important to remember that while it is structured as a mandatory sentence, judges do have discretion to veer from three-strike sentences. It is not total discretion, but there is a limited discretion to strike prior convictions if they feel the interests of justice so require. Now, they don't have complete discretion to do this, and that is true, but judges have done this. And so, which is one of the reasons why when you see these people that come before courts, mm-hmm. even for crimes, which are, by the way, still felonies, that some people may consider relatively trivial, although they are still felonies.
Well, they're bumped up into felonies by, as we heard earlier, by this 100-year-old law in California.
Less than 10% of three-strike sentences have that as their last felony. And when they do, you usually find more aggravated circumstances than mm-hmm. you normally would. Mm-hmm. Within the universe of people who can be sentenced to three-strike sentences, not all of the ones whose last one was petty theft with a prior get the three-strike sentence. Mm-hmm. Either the prosecutor declines to make the prosecution, or to press for the three-strike sentence, as is his or her ability to do so, or judges will strike one or more of the prior convictions in order for there not to be a three-strike sentence.
And yet it's out there, and it's working, and it's working often. What do you think, listeners? Is three strikes and you're out good American justice or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Michael's on the line. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hello, sir. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I call and I understand and embrace the idea of three strikes for violent crimes against a person, and I think it's probably a good idea to draw that line in the, that line in the sand.
Mm-hmm.
But I worry about the idea that we've talked about already. The punishment is too great for the crime. And if someone steals videotapes three times, mm-hmm. that person is potentially up for a lifetime sentence.
Well, I don't think it's quite that simple, but we get your idea. Go on, Michael.
But one of the things I wonder about, if someone does this three or four times and is caught three or four times, is it possible? But I worry about the CEO. What about the CEO who at one time steals $5 billion from a company? Is he up for a lifetime sentence? Or even though he's done greater crime to our society than the person who's stolen a videotape three different times, this person will face a sentence of something, but definitely not a sentence of life. And I wonder, how can we justify that? How can we justify one person stealing $5 billion from a company and from life savings?
Yeah, the spotlight has really turned. Michael, we've got your point. Charles Hobson, how about it? When we look out across the whole country, we see everything that's been going on in recent years. Does it become any more difficult in your mind to justify these enormous sentences when we see crimes of many kinds being perpetrated, but not every kind of criminal facing that kind of sentence?
Well, it's important, first of all, to note that in order to be sentenced under the three strikes law, stealing videotapes three times won't do it.
Right.
Your prior convictions have to be violent or serious felonies.
Mm-hmm.
Primarily the felonies like rape or murder or aggravated assault or burglary.
So Winona Ryder is not on her way house today.
They acquitted her for burglary anyway, so she won't get a strike anyhow.
But grand theft and vandalism aren't enough to set her on the
strike step letter. They aren't considered strikes under the three strikes law, and she has no prior convictions.
Mm-hmm.
As for the CEO stealing billions of dollars, I agree that many times the white-collar crimes, the sentences are far, far too small. But it's also interesting to note that it would still be considered a nonviolent crime. And the critics of three strikes harp on nonviolent crimes for your final conviction and being mm-hmm. sentenced under the three strikes law. These crimes, under their interpretation, if you had like two prior burglary convictions, which is unlikely to have and become a CEO and do this, but if you did, you couldn't be sentenced under the three strikes law. My argument to the gentleman who just called is increase the penalties for white collar crimes. I have no problems with that.
Oh, this brings up so many issues. I guess the first, Evan Lee, is, you know, okay, let's say that I've got two violent felonies, but then I put a stop to that. I lose my head one day and I steal that video. I haven't repeated the violent felony that's got me into this precarious situation. Is it really fair to send me up the river for life when I've held off the serious crime?
Well, not only is it not fair, but it's not. There's no valid penological reason for it. You're not that kind of danger to society any longer. And three strikes, as I say, it doesn't have that individualized component to it. They're just. I mean, the California version of three strikes has a lot fewer discretionary aspects to it than some of the other three strikes laws that you see around the country. But I just want to say this to the caller when he says, you know, three videotapes is when you say three videotapes is not going to do the job. But it could do the job if, for example, I don't think people understand how easy it is to commit a residential burglary in the state of California. Residential burglary in the state, walking through the open back door of your neighbor's house to take cookies from the jar is a residential burglary.
And then you're on to the three-strike escalator?
I beg your pardon?
Then you're on into the three-strike maw?
Yes, you are. That becomes a strike. So if the three incidents of videotapes that the caller is talking about, if you walk through the back door of your neighbor's house to steal a videotape and you do that on two occasions and then the third time you take it from a video store, now you're into three strikes.
Thierry is calling on the line. Welcome, Thierry. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Actually, I'm French, and I liked your Jean Valjean analogy in the beginning.
The loaf of bread, and pretty soon he's lashed to an oar. It has a similar sound to it, but is it really the same thing?
Well, Jean Valjean was on the run.
Yeah, he was out.
But the thing that I see, I am French. I lived in the U.S. and Canada, and I do live in the U.S. now.
Mm-hmm.
But from a French perspective, when I look at this, it seems to be extremely harsh, and it almost has a popular appeal for black and white justice, for putting away people, even using a analogy with baseball, three strikes and you're out. It has so much.
Too flippant for you.
Yeah, that's right. It has so much. It hits to the core of culture, and I did appreciate the comments about the socioeconomic reasons for crime.
So you, the voice from the land of Victor Hugo, what do you suggest as an alternative?
Well, Well, the thing is this, is I do believe that the crimes are punished. I do believe that there's 1 year, 2 years, or whatnot. And if somebody is to commit the crime over and over again, they will realize that the price for petty theft is high. And there's no reason to put them away for 25 years, 50 years. At that point, you either get them a therapist or help them get a job. And instead of putting the money in jails and whatnot, helping people in bad economic situation to recover. As a matter of fact, it almost seems like it is easy politically to encourage tough crime, death penalty, and putting people away for life if you're just about to prepare yourself for a incredible economic downturn where you need to control the masses and not the CEOs.
Yeah, well, I wonder, Terry, thanks for your call. Charles Hobson, how about it? What was the problem? What would be the problem now with simply handing out consecutive normal sentences for these crimes? I mean, that's also prison time that should be a deterrent, shouldn't it?
Well, but for some people, it doesn't. Mr. Ewing, he had, I think, 12 prior convictions, and not all of them resulted in prison sentences, but many, many of them did. He had just finished serving sentence for, I think, it was three prior burglary. Prior burglary and robbery convictions. I think one robbery and two burglary convictions. He comes out of jail, and in less than a year, he's caught stealing golf clubs. He's caught stealing $1,500, not just three golf clubs, but $1,500 worth of golf clubs.
Are you an attorney, Charles Hobson?
Yes.
So, I mean, you've had your training. Does it give you no pause to think, what about the limiting principle here? I mean, the last crime was three golf clubs shoved down his pants leg. Does it keep you awake at night thinking of him, you know, in jail for 25 years, the rest of his life?
Well, because how many more crimes does he have to commit? And also remember that people who commit many, many crimes like this usually wind up committing many, many more crimes they're never caught for. And now you can't convict somebody for a crime they haven't been you can't convict somebody for a crime they haven't been convicted of. Uncharged offenses have been used to help increase people's sentences. And the fact is, these people commit an awful lot of crimes, and therapy isn't going to change it for them. We tried to do stuff like that in the 60s and 70s, and it was a disaster. And what happened was that people revolted against that, and because the people have much more influence on sentencing decisions and the conduct of the criminal law in this country than they do in France, people have done things like the three strikes law, which is one of the reasons why the French have a much worse crime problem than we do.
Evan Lee, we've just got a few seconds before the break, but do you think Californians would enact this law all over again? Do they like it?
I don't think they'd enact it again if they could look 15, 20 years in the future and see how many aged 75 and 80 year olds we're going to have that we're going to be supporting, paying $30,000-$40,000 a year, looking at support those people and what danger are they to society?
Well, it's not a pretty picture, but yet people don't want crime either. We're talking tonight about three strikes and you're out in California's courts, about crime and life sentences and justice. Does this kind of sentencing dehumanize justice, or does the cost of crime outweigh the cost of crowded prisons and hard justice? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about California's three strikes and you're out sentencing guidelines, about crime and life sentences and justice. California has 344 shoplifters in prison for 25 years to life, including people who took off with a $20 bottle of vitamins, a $3 magazine, a $25 car alarm, pizza. There were serious crimes before those, but these were the ones that sent them off to prison. How does it look to you? Do we need to put thieves of golf clubs and vitamins away for life to deter a larger wave of crime? And is three strikes and you're out a leftover of 80s and 90s crime phobia? Have we moved beyond it, or do we need it now more than ever? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Peter's on the line. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
One of your guests had touched on a point I want to make. At $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year, you're going to incarcerate somebody for stealing $150 worth of videotapes. I mean, you could pay this person half the money that you're going to spend to incarcerate them, and they'd never steal again, and the state would still come out ahead.
Well, what if Polly Class, the 12-year-old who was kidnapped and murdered, what if that had been in your neighborhood, and you felt like there was a wave of that going on around? How would you draw a line in the sand, Peter?
It's just ridiculous that you're going to incarcerate somebody for property crimes. I mean, nonviolent crimes, I understand, but property crimes, and you're going to spend that much money. You know, the state budgets are limited. what a waste of money. You're going to spend that much money to incarcerate somebody for stealing videotapes? It's absurd.
We've got it. Peter, thanks for your call. Charles Hobson, what about it? The cost is very high. How do you justify it?
Well, you also have to include the savings in crimes not committed by these people. What's interesting is the corrections as a percentage of the state budget is now lower than it was, slightly lower, but still lower than it was when the three strikes law passed. Now, while the absolute amount of money spent on corrections has increased, the state budget has gone up even more during the period of the three strikes, since the three strikes law was passed. And now, by the way, as to some of your examples, that the pizza thief, which is commonly used, mm-hmm. that the pizza thief was a man who was 6'4", 245 pounds, had several very, very prior convictions of very, very serious violent crimes, and he threatened an 8-year-old he was going to kill the 8-year-old's mother if, I think it was a boy, if the boy didn't give him the piece of pizza. And I think that guy certainly deserves to be put in prison for as long as he can.
Well, there are always details here, and still,
and
still,
one of the interesting things is what
pizza.
Happens. I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt.
Not at all.
It's a tendency as with the opponents of three strikes to overgeneralize by sometimes not looking at the entirety of the person's prior record,
mm-hmm.
or sometimes what they did in the crimes, which is what prosecutors and judges do in these cases.
No, we understand that these criminals do not come to this final offense with pretty records, not at all, and yet the sound of some of these that ultimately send them off. Evan Lee, speak to us as a professor of law about the Constitution here. What is the precedent around the Eighth Amendment and cruel and unusual punishment? Is there no clear guideline to say that's just too much for this crime?
Well, that's a disputed matter. I mean, that's essentially what they're arguing in the Supreme Court right
mm-hmm.
now. The precedents are a 1983 case called Solemn versus Helm, in which the Supreme Court declared unconstitutional a life sentence for a man who had a record, a rather lengthy record, but his triggering offense was he passed a bad check for $100,
mm-hmm.
and the court declared that was unconstitutional. Then subsequent to that, they decided a case, I think in 1991, called Harmelin versus Michigan, in which the key opinion, I think, is Justice Kennedy's concurrence, and he attempts to put some gloss, as the lawyers call it, or some limits on the proportionality analysis of Solemn versus Helm. So, I mean, the court right now is being asked essentially to clarify its jurisprudence or to think more harder about its jurisprudence. Should courts be able to engage in proportionality analysis at all for non-capital crimes?
And judges do not have full discretion to do that now.
Well, I think as somebody alluded to earlier, certainly the Supreme Court of the United States has not done that very often. I think Solemn is the one case. I think maybe Rummel versus Estelle is the other. But in any event, the courts, I mean, the idea that there's going to be the floodgates argument. Well, if we start to scrutinize the proportionality of the sentence in this one case, then we're going to have to do it in all cases. I mean, very sparingly
mm-hmm.
that discretion, that power, judicial power, has been very sparingly exercised.
It gets to the point of a greater good, you could argue, that's being protected here by these draconian punishments versus the individual rights. And at some point, I wonder where that line should be. Tom's on the line. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. The show's great.
Thanks.
I just want to add that, when I think that when we think of our society, it's hard for us as Americans to, in our free society, that is, to comprehend such harsh, as you will, draconian punishments.
Mm-hmm.
But when Americans or people from the Western world travel to places like Singapore, we're always blown away by, you spit on the sidewalk in Singapore, it's $1,000 fine. If you don't flush a public toilet, you could go to jail for a week. I mean, it's like we as Americans go crazy and think, oh my God, that's so archaic and how brutal that is. But yet their society is such that, or in Japan, for instance, you'll walk in downtown Tokyo, people pull up in their bicycles and walk into a store and walk back out. No one locks anything. No one leaves.
Tom, as an American, what do you think of that? I mean, we could follow the Saudi or Iraqi example and lop off hands and feet and legs and heads.
No. I think you draw a line as far as cruelty in terms of maiming people. That's
25 years to life doesn't sound cruel?
Well, in a way, it does to us and you. It's hard for you to fathom
mm-hmm.
that. But one problem, a fundamental problem I think we as Americans have is we forget that, and what's gone on in our society is that no one takes responsibility for their own actions. And the lack of responsibility on people in our society has gotten out of control. There's no respect for authority. There's no respect for this, for that. We always look to blame, you know, how the person was brought up and blame the condition that they're in.
Yeah, but still, we hear you loud and clear, Tom, but still I wonder if just putting people away for so very long really sounds constitutional, really sounds in the spirit of American justice, American life. Let's get another call. Adam's on the line. Hi, Adam. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Please excuse me my babble. I'm used to a little more visual feedback from the people I'm talking to. I feel like the discussion's gotten a little sidetracked because the cases in point you're discussing are so patently ludicrous. They're obviously exceptions.
So where do you want to focus with Adam? Make it quick. Our time's running down.
What I think is that what we need to be asking is, what is the point of the correctional system? Is it deterrence? Is it public safety? You know, is it an economic issue, as I think one of your prior callers mentioned? Clearly, this isn't going to deter people because they're already repeat offenders. I mean, no matter what you say is going to happen to you, they're going to keep committing crimes.
Well, but Charles Hobson and others argue that, in fact, it does deter criminals, that they worry about that third crime that puts them away perhaps for life.
Well, I mean, it didn't seem to deter these guys who stole some videotapes and went to jail for 50 years. I mean, if that's not going to deter you, what is? I mean, clearly something else is at work here. And I think that maybe instead of saying, well, as a society, we are incapable of dealing with people committing repeated crimes, so we're going to sweep them under the rug by banishing them, maybe we can use this as a springboard to address the greater issue of why are these people repeatedly committing crimes. And I wonder if your guests have anything to say about that.
Adam, thanks for your call. Evan Lee, how about that? Do you see any move among the California electorate to themselves come in and fine-tune this policy?
Well, it's very difficult. I mean, normally, you know, the court would be right to accord deference to the legislative judgment, but the California three strikes is really more a product of the initiative process, as Frank Zimmering told you earlier.
But that could be used again, couldn't it? If it's going to cost California so much, maybe there'll be another ballot initiative to fine-tune the sentencing guidelines.
Well, I think that is in the works, but let's face it, what happens is, you know, the whole thing gets demagogued on, you know, soft on crime and that sort of thing. The big problem here is that the initiative that passed three strikes puts a restriction on the legislature. I mean, normally the legislature would be able to fine-tune or fix the laws that need fixing, criminal laws that need fixing, by a simple majority. But that's not three strikes, which has a provision, the initiative has a provision in it, which says that it has to be two-thirds of the legislature to even make the finest, you know, change or tweaking of this statute.
Even a tweak. And with that, I'm afraid we're out of time. Evan Lee, professor of criminal law, University of California, Hastings College of Law, thank you for joining
thank
us.
Thank you.
And Charles Hobson, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you very much.
Charles Hobson is an attorney for the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation that filed an amicus brief with these cases before the Supreme Court. Listeners, you can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, reflections on the first day of Ramadan. This is On Point. Today marks the beginning of the Islamic holy month of Ramadan. Ramadan is the month when Muslims believe Allah revealed the Quran to Muhammad. For 1.2 billion Muslims around the world, including 7 million in the United States, Ramadan is a period of daily fasting and intense self-reflection. But for many, this year's observation is being shrouded by the threat of a U.S.-led war on Iraq and the continuing violence between Israelis and Palestinians. In this radio diary, 26-year-old American Muslim Zad Ashai explains what Ramadan means to him and why he's looking forward to the next 30 days.
Essentially, Ramadan is one of the five pillars in the Islamic faith. And during this month, Muslims fast from sunrise to sunset for either 30 or 29 days during the month. And Ramadan is a month where Muslims fast, but it's a lot bigger than just fasting, essentially. It's a month for personal reflection, for spiritual reflection. It's a month where Muslims tend to gather in congregations more often, pray a lot more. It's also, there's a huge communal aspect to it. People spend times at the mosque. They spend times doing charitable works. It's essentially a month of self-improvement. I mean, it's a challenge, but, you know, the way I look at it, it's a really a blessing. It's not a burden that someone's put on us. You know, a lot of coworkers ask me, oh, I'm sure you know exactly what time sunset is because you must be looking forward to the meal, but it really, it doesn't work like that. I was, you know, we were talking, you know, in my schoolwork, when I was in school, my grades would actually go up during Ramadan because you tend to be more focused. In sports, when I played tennis in high school, actually my record was better during Ramadan than it was outside Ramadan. So it's a time, you know, where you really have this, it's a time to essentially reflect. It's a time where you become a lot more humble. It's a time where you're reminded about the needy outside, because you yourself expect, you know, feel hunger, feel some type of deprivation, so you can empathize with people who are going through that on a daily basis, not just in Ramadan. And, you know, the way I look at it, it's almost similar to, you know, a time period like New Year resolutions. It's a time for Muslims, it's almost the beginning of a new year. It's a time to reflect what you've done well in the past, what you haven't done well, and try to make resolutions that you're going to improve for the next year. Compared to, say, 3 or 4 years ago, a lot more people are aware that it's Ramadan. A lot more people are aware what a Muslim is, what Islam is. But, you know, there's all sorts of, you know, different reactions you get. You know, Muslims traditionally break the fast with a date. It's a cultural practice that's done by most Muslims. And, you know, sometimes, you know, when you're meeting, it's common practice to make sure you break fast on time. So if you're in a meeting, just, you know, starting shoving a couple dates in your mouth, you know, you get a couple weird looks in the meeting. But people, you know, I'm surprised, are a lot more aware of Ramadan than they were, say, 5 or 6 years ago. I mean, it's a tough time for the Islamic community in the U.S. There's no denying that. Whether Muslims are getting hassled more in airports or all the negative press, it's definitely had a significant impact on the Muslim community. You know, members report small things as harassment in the workplace, harassment in public places. But, you know, as Muslims, Ramadan's a time where people really focus on peace, essentially inner peace and outer peace, meaning that looking to resolve conflicts through diplomatic means, looking to resolve conflicts through negotiation. And, you know, Muslims essentially are supposed to be ambassadors of peace. But it's a very tough time when certain groups, unfortunately, have used Islam for their political ends and really harmed the larger Islamic community.
Zahid Ashai is 26 years old. He lives in Boston, Massachusetts. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, Kelly Jones, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Darren Manoogian, Sabi Mir, and Oliver Reed. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Gregorian Oriental Rugs.